Okay, so this is the 9/11 Truth and Other 9/11 and Other Deepfake Crimes teleconference for the 29th of August, 2018. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis facilitating, and Craig McKee, secretary. You want to call the roll, Craig?
Sure. Okay, I'll read what I have here in front of me. I have Barbara Honegger, Charles Ewing Smith, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Ken Freeland, David Cole, Lawrence Fine, Frank Tolopko, John O'Malley. I have Lawrence Fine twice for some reason. I'm not sure why. Also Tom Tweeden, Wayne Costey, and Sue Wheaton. I just have asked here, but I think it is. Okay.
I called Sue Wheaton. Yes.
Sue Wheaton. Great. And I have Roger Borys on here too. I don't know. I missed him the first time. And Peter Ketchum just joined, T.F. Soto, Nita Renfrew, Marty Hopper, and Marie Spike. So, did I get everyone?
Mick Harrison.
Right? Oh, Mick Harrison? Okay.
Malcolm Arnold.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So that's everybody.
All right. Very good. So then we move on to approval of the minutes from the previous teleconference as circulated by Craig and then repeated by myself, the draft agenda. Any amendments to the minutes? Okay. Well, I would like to make an amendment to the minutes. I believe there was a transcription error, Craig, but when you wrote out the rule that Barbara had recommended and that we passed, there's a syntax error in there. So it says either on the teleconference and off the teleconference, which is, of course, not good English. So I'm asking that we change the and to both to make it grammatically sensible, since this will be a rule that we'll refer back to in the course of time. Okay. Any objections to changing and to both so that we have grammatical purity here? Hearing none of that's the way the rule will stand. Both on the teleconference, either on the teleconference or off the teleconference, right? Is that what we just said? Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Any other amendments to the minutes? All right, hearing none, we'll take the minutes as approved as amended and move on to tonight's draft agenda, which has been circulated. Any objections to using the draft agenda as circulated for our working agenda tonight? Any for additions or deletions or anything? Well, good. We're moving very quickly ahead here, and we're ready to get into our first item. And that will be one of our guests of honor, Mick Harrison, and Barbara Honegger will introduce him. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay, well, I'm just really pleased to have Mick Harrison on the call today, as everybody probably knows. By the way, I'm getting some feedback from my voice. Is everybody else getting
feedback? I'm going to look and see who's...
There's some noise going on in the background that's not related to Barbara's voice, Ken, that started before she was speaking. So somebody's banging things around in the background.
Sounds like a dog barking and banging things.
Yeah.
Could everybody mute, please?
Could you still hear the noise?
It seems to be gone. Yes.
Okay. It seems to be gone. Okay,
Roger,
good.
I think it was Roger Borys' phone. I muted him. Go ahead.
Okay, great. All right, starting over. Well, I still hear like a dog barking in the background. That could be from my voice.
Should we not be in lecture mode, Kevin?
I'm just going to say let's go into lecture mode, and we'll unmute Barbara and Mick.
I Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, good. I think you originally muted me. Well, I can still hear feedback from my voice.
Okay, the problem is Nick is still muted, and I cannot identify his phone number here.
Nick, if you can hear us, what's your phone number?
He can't speak. He's muted like everyone else.
Oh.
Are you on a speakerphone, Barbara?
Yeah, you want me to go off of it?
It would probably make the sound a lot better.
Yeah,
all right,
I got a feeling that's the problem too.
Yeah.
Let me try.
I'm gonna unmute this line and see who shows up. Who can speak now?
Hello, Barb.
Hello.
Hello.
Richard Gage, are you on the call?
Yeah. Hi.
Oh, hi,
okay.
Richard.
Oh, there really is.
Hi, Richard.
Okay, because I thought maybe that was Nick with and it was someone showing up as you. So okay, that's not. I don't see Nick's number on here, Nick's name on here anywhere. So I guess we're gonna have to go off of this for a moment.
We have two Lawrences on here.
I still hear the background noise, even when I'm not speaking.
Yeah.
By the way.
I know. I hear it too. I'm afraid that might just be a problem. We're not gonna be able to do anything about tonight. But let me. Nick, can you give me the first three digits of your phone number, please?
I'm calling from Sky, so I don't know what that is.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, well, maybe that's one of the Lorenzo findings. So, Lorenzo, 646320, is that your number, Lorenzo?
No.
It is not. All right, and... you said you saw two Lorenzos.
Yeah, well, we have the 978 one and the 646 one. So if it's not the 646 one, that means somebody else is calling from that number.
978 number.
That's Lawrence.
This is Malcolm. I have a 646 number.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Ah, okay.
Hey, I had my phone muted on my end.
Yeah, okay, so we need to change that, first of all. So the other Lorenzo find is actually Malcolm Arnold.
Okay.
Well, it looks. My guess is that we're not going to be able to do lecture mode because Nick is on Skype and we don't have a way of unmuting him.
Well, can I just ask you, is it possible for Nick to just call in on his cell?
I can. Does that solve a problem?
Nick, if you also have a set of headphones, what that generally does is that by using a set of headphones, you reduce the feedback.
Okay, let me just call in and see what happens.
That would be better. Yeah. Shall I go ahead and introduce Nick while he's doing this?
Yeah, I don't think he'll mind missing his own introduction.
Probably not.
He
okay.
Probably knows who he is.
Well, are we still hearing the background noise? I don't think so much.
Well, I will put it back on lecture mode then. Because there is some background noise, but it may be coming from your phone, Barbara, if you're still on speakerphone.
No, I'm not. How's that?
That's good. Sounds good so far.
Okay, let's introduce Nick finally. nothing's ever easy, is it? Okay.
Hey, this is Nick.
Oh, good, you're back. Let's see if we still have the background noise. I don't think it's as bad.
No.
There's still background noise. Yeah.
Question, what is the mute number again?
*6.
Okay, I'm going to mute just to make sure it's me too.
Yeah, everybody should mute except for Mick and myself and the moderator.
Yeah, please mute *6, everyone, and then that way we'll be able to limit the background noise.
Okay. Shall I go ahead?
Yeah.
All right. Finally. Third time's the charm. Okay. So I'm just really excited to have Mick Harrison on the call as our special guest tonight, or one of our special guests. As many of you know, or maybe all of you, Mick Harrison is really the hub, the most important person in the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Now, that's my personal opinion, and he'll probably disagree with me, nevertheless. Mick is both the executive director and the director of litigation and the vice president of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, which, of course, on April 10th, filed an incredibly historic petition calling for a new and the first ever federal criminal grand jury, special criminal grand jury, to reinvestigate the truth about what really happened at the World Trade Center on 9/11. And then on July 30th, and Mick will be, I'm sure, explaining why, the Lawyers Committee filed a supplement, or an amendment, excuse me, an amendment to that petition that added three more federal statutes that apply to the petition, and he will be explaining that. So that's Mick's current claim to fame, and he's going to be talking tonight about, more in general, though, the deep state and his understanding of it and how it relates to 9/11. But let me introduce him. So Mick Harrison is an attorney. He's the, as I mentioned, a public interest attorney, graduate summa cum laude of the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. He is a national practice, has a national practice focused on cases involving whistleblower protection, which he usually wins, by the way, government accountability, corporate fraud and false claims, and dangers to public health and the environment. Over the past 2.5 decades, Mick has worked in partnership with such important cases with the Government Accountability Project, also known as GAP, G-A-P, the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, also known as PEER, P-E-E-R, the Chemical Weapons Working Group, and the National Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and the Vietnam Veterans Organizations, among many others. He is licensed in the state of Pennsylvania and admitted to practice before the U.S. Courts of Appeal for the 3rd, 4th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th districts, the District of Columbia, and the Federal Circuit Courts, as well as for the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana. So with that, Mick, take it away.
Oh, one moment, please. One moment, please. Cheryl, I don't see Tony Hall yet on the call, and I want to ask if you have a way of contacting him directly, if you could drop off and see if you could remind him that he's on the call tonight.
Can
you hear me?
Tony is here.
Yeah.
This is Tony Hall. Yeah.
Oh, Tony, you're on the call. Tony. Oh, good. You didn't show up on our list, and so I thought you weren't here. Okay. Good deal. Thank you.
I've been following all the logistical twists.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Okay, so I'm sorry. Please proceed, Mick, and welcome again to the 9/11 teleconference.
Well, thank you all for having me. I have a lot of information to try to touch on here in a short period of time. If I do go too fast, just tell me to slow down. My main interest is in sharing with you my thoughts about deep state issues and how to address them based on my experience over the last 30 years, basically, doing public interest law, litigation and advocacy, and investigative work. And I suspect there may be some of these topics of greater interest to you than others. And I hope to have time to give you some cheap advice at the end, which you're free to ignore. One of the cases that first got my attention got me thinking about sort of what I call systemic corruption in the government and broader, that to me at least is, if not synonymous with the deep state, at least a symptom of it. And that was when I went to GAP way back in 1990. My first whistleblower case, or close to it, was a lawyer, whistleblower who worked for the federal government, chief of the Criminal Enforcement Council Division of USEPA. And he was receiving, I remember the time period here, 1990 or so, he was receiving from his colleagues in EPA criminal enforcement across the country information about cases of environmental crime prosecutions that were being politically interfered with. And the shocking part to me was the entity doing the political interference was at very high levels in the U.S. Department of Justice, meaning headquarters very high up. And so that was sort of my first indication that something was amiss. We did represent that whistleblower successfully. In the process, litigating his case, we subpoenaed an assistant. That's probably not the right word. It would be a deputy attorney general, probably one step down from the attorney general. And before we could actually depose that person, we did have to fight a battle to get the right to depose them, but we won that. Once it became clear we were going to be able to depose that person, the case settled. Our client had turned over his information on this political interference to John Dingell, Congressperson John Dingell, who had an investigative committee at that time. Shortly thereafter, those investigative committees were disbanded by the Bush administration. I think that was probably Bush Sr., who I call Bush Sr. But during that time, there was an active investigation. However, Congress never got to the bottom of it because before that could be concluded, the investigative committees got disbanded. So that was sort of my first red flag that something was amiss, and I've had red flags pretty much every year over the last 25 to 30 years since then. More recently, some of you know, I represented a senior scientist at EPA who disclosed to the FBI and to Congress the fact that the dust from the World Trade Center collapse on 9/11 was much more dangerous than had been disclosed. And she was fired, of course, and I represented her with my co-counsel from Peer. We did win her case. She's back at work. And but that was an interesting story. But another example of the government doing the wrong thing on very important issues. One of my earliest cases was an Agent Orange incinerator case in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was the governor, so we were actually suing Bill Clinton because it was a state-run hazardous waste cleanup using an incinerator to burn Agent Orange waste, which I can, if you don't know, I can tell you is a very bad idea. But the reason I mention it is two things. One is through some investigation with Greenpeace scientists and others, and also an investigator who disclosed some Army documents that I don't think have yet seen the light of day, and this was 20-some years ago, it became clear to me that the U.S. Army was exploring the chemical known as dioxin. For some of you who are more technically inclined, 2,3,7,8-tetrachlorodibenzo-p-dioxin, the very bad actor in Agent Orange, they were exploring this chemical prior to Vietnam, just prior to Vietnam, as a chemical weapon. And later, it became known, of course, that many of our troops, as well as who knows how many folks who live in Vietnam, were killed or made ill by exposure to this highly toxic chemical in Agent Orange. But no one was really told that the Army was exploring it before Vietnam as a chemical weapon. The other interesting fact, or one of the other key facts about that case, was we got three injunctions from the Federal District Court from a Republican-appointed judge shutting down that incinerator based primarily on whistleblower disclosures. And notwithstanding that, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit reversed those injunctions and allowed the facility to continue to operate, even though we had folks telling us who worked there that it was knowingly being operated illegally, and they were actually burning Agent Orange on the outside of the incinerator rather than the inside, which I can also tell you is a bad practice. But the Court of Appeals reversed those injunctions, and in one case, they used a highly irregular procedure, which was we'd gone up to St. Louis to argue to that court on one of the injunctions, and after making the argument, we started to walk out of the courtroom, and the judges said, "Don't go away. We now want to take argument on the more recent injunction issued by the district court, which hadn't even been appealed yet." And if any of you who have legal backgrounds, you're going to know how irregular that is. They had no jurisdiction because there was no notice of appeal filed. Nobody had briefed it, so it wasn't time for oral argument, and yet we did an oral argument on the spot without any preparation because we were ordered to do so. Shortly after that, the court lifted that injunction as well, and a lot of folks would have been harmed much more than they were from that incinerator had we not put enough pressure on EPA by whistleblower disclosures, which thankfully were put on the front page of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette in more than one article, not to mention a number of good political cartoons, and, long story short, the incinerator was eventually shut down before they got to the really nasty Agent Orange waste, the 245G waste, with the most dioxin, and we at least accomplished most of the mission. But in the process of investigating all what I'm telling you, in short, a reporter for the Democrat Gazette made some inquiries into potential ex parte communications with the U.S. Court of Appeals. And shortly after she made those inquiries, somebody literally attempted to murder her by shooting a high caliber bullet through her windshield of her car while she was driving in on a highway, and narrowly missing her. So that was another red flag that something wasn't quite right. Another case that was of interest was the WTI hazardous waste incinerator case. I can't tell you all about it, but the short version is we disclosed to the court and the public that EPA had been covering up for years the risk to the public health from food chain contamination from combustion sources. There are a lot of different contaminants. Mercury is certainly known to be one, but we were talking about dioxin in that case. And we disclosed a secret memo that EPA had not distributed to anyone except internally that a whistleblower gave us, which basically said that Greenpeace, my client, was right, that the food chain risk was orders of magnitude, meaning hundreds or thousands of times, maybe 10,000 times greater than inhalation risk. But EPA was focused on only looking at inhalation risk in their public documents from combustion sources. So we brought this document into the courtroom to show it to the judge to get our first injunction, which we did get. And as soon as we distributed it and offered it to the court, the EPA and the DOJ asked the court to order us to give the document back because they said it was executive privilege, but at the same time they were saying we couldn't prove it was authentic, which I thought was a pretty interesting argument. But as a cheap suggestion for strategy, if you ever get into a situation like that, what we in Greenpeace did was, anticipating the government would try to get their document back, we had the foresight to fax it to news media around the country the night before. So in the hearing, the press were there in the jury box holding their copies. And so the judge looked at the Department of Justice lawyer and said, well, I think the toothpaste is out of the tube on this one. You know, you won't be getting your document back. So there's more to that case, but that was, and in fact, when on appeal, we ended up losing that case, even though we won it before the district court, because the Court of Appeals decided to change the law or, quote, clarify it to say we couldn't use the legal mechanism we were using. That happened to us in another case on another incinerator related to dioxin in Pennsylvania, the Drake chemical incinerator, where we won the case not only in the district court, we won it on appeal, but the appellate panel invited the entire Third Circuit to revisit the case, which is unusual, and the Third Circuit decided to look at it en banc, which means every judge in the circuit, and then they decided to change the law, and so we ended up losing that case even though we won it. So these are examples of some experiences that indicate that the system isn't working as designed. How am I doing on time? Give me a time check, somebody. Anybody not on mute or can tell me?
Yeah, you've taken about 15 minutes of a 20-minute reserve. So,
I'm not hearing you very well, but it sounded like I've got about 5 minutes left.
Let's get to 9/11.
Okay, so I'm telling you what I came to tell you about. I think Barbara, maybe someone else put on the agenda that I would talk about the latest on our 9/11 efforts from the Lawyers Committee. Mm-hmm. That's actually not why I requested to be on your call, but I'll tell you the latest. And the short version is, Barb stated it, we did file a petition to give our evidence of demolition to a federal grand jury. We filed an amended petition July 30th, which very few people know about, which added three other federal crimes to our petition. And we are waiting to hear back from the Department of Justice and what they're going to do with our petition. Most of you know by now that our petition identifies a federal law that requires the U.S. attorney to give our evidence to the grand jury. And if they don't, we are contemplating legal action to force that to happen. You'll have to stay tuned for the details on that. We are involved in some interesting Freedom of Information cases, which is one of the examples of cheap advice I intended to give you on this call, which is to make maximum use of that law in your efforts to expose the deep state corruption. We are currently active in getting records from the coroner in Shanksville for Flight 93, from getting, and I say we, I mean the Lawyers Committee and relevant others, including David Cole on this call, David Meiswinkle on our board. And we're also getting records regarding the who I call and the FBI calls the high fivers arrested on 9/11 in New Jersey from the New Jersey State Police. And we are in active litigation expecting a decision momentarily from the U.S. District Court in D.C. on David Cole's request for FEMA documents regarding the data underlying the building performance study on the collapse of the Trade Center buildings. We may and expect to get discovery, the ability to subpoena people to depose them and get additional records in that case, which is rare in FOIA cases and more rare in 9/11-related cases. So stand by for news on that. That's the short version. We are contemplating some additional litigation, which we haven't committed to, and so I can't really talk about it in detail yet. So I'm happy to answer questions. Let me give you one more highlight from my previous work, which I think is related to what you're doing, and that is I did have some cases related to the military and chemical and biological weapons, more than one. Some are environmental citizen suits, some are whistleblower cases. The short version of what I learned in those cases was that, one, the Army and its contractors do tend to retaliate against whistleblowers, pretty systematically. Another was that there's been historically very lax control on access to both chemical and biological weapons, and it is very likely that intelligence agencies have access to one or both, not through any means that's on the record. The last time I checked, this was in 2001, Doug Way, chemist, whistleblower, the Army was still sending anthrax through FedEx across the country, which is probably not a good practice. So there's more to that, but the bottom line in all this is, of course, when you put the pieces together, and there are more pieces than I have time to tell you, I have seen what I consider to be the symptoms of deep state corruption in my cases for the last 25 years. And so I am recommending, and I don't know what you all have been doing or are doing, and you don't need to tell me, so I may be preaching to the choir here, but some of the things we're doing with the Lawyers Committee procedurally may be of interest and may be of help to you. The short version is we're obviously using a nonprofit corporation as our primary structural vehicle. We're using a team. We're not doing a sort of a Rambo thing, individual heroic efforts, which I highly recommend. We haven't done enough of this, but we intend to support and encourage whistleblowers, which I recommend as a strategy for you all. We're doing what we can to build a coalition, but of course on this issue there is already a fairly wide coalition. We're using what I call and what I learned at GAP to be the campaign approach, which is don't rely on any single strategy such as protest or litigation or media. We're working with Congress, public education, go down the list. What you need is to design an intelligent combination of strategies for the particular problem you're trying to solve in the moment. And each of these strategies tends to be synergistic with the others. I've suggested you use maximum use of the Freedom of Information Act. If you want to know more about how to do that, feel free to talk to me or David Cole. I'm volunteering him, but if he's willing. David has educated me on use of these mandatory declassification requests, which are not FOIA requests, but is a structure that citizens can use to get documents previously classified, to get them unclassified and released, which I definitely recommend to your attention. I also recommend that you should not take for granted that just because Congress is keeping some critical information secret, that Congress is entitled to keep that information secret. And Barb can tell you more about this in the 28 pages, but you also should not accept the executive branch saying that some congressional document is secret, because as we learned with the 28 pages, because of separation of powers, the executive branch cannot classify congressional documents. Only Congress can decide to keep those documents secret, which the Constitution generally requires to be published. So those are the main suggestions other than strategic litigation. There are a number of laws which you're welcome to ask me about, which might be of use to deep state advocates. So I'll stop there, and if there is time, I'll take questions.
Okay, thank you, Mick. We're going to go into Q&A session now, so if you wish to ask a question, star 6, or make a comment, star 6, and you'll go into the queue. While we're waiting for that, Mick, I'd like to ask you, what is the timeline for the Attorney General's response to your petition before you would need to consider alternative action to force it? Oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry, Mick, that may put you on mute. Oh, I cannot unmute you. Oh, wait a minute, I should be able to unmute you because you called in on... Oh, yeah, there you are. Hang on. Okay, there you are, Mick.
Okay, have you got me?
Yep.
Okay, so there's no deadline set by law. We are giving the DOJ several months, and then we're going to take appropriate legal action if the DOJ doesn't respond. You'll hear more about our specific plans in our anniversary event in New York on the 10th, and probably some more details in D.C. on the 11th with a architects and engineers event.
Okay, thank you. All right, so yep. Looks like Matthew Arnold would like to ask your question. Go ahead, Martha. Malcolm?
Yeah, in your defense of, let me know if you can hear me properly, if yes. not, in your defense of whistleblowers, as a former intelligence officer who has looked at whistleblowers and the information they presented as they go on tour and they speak about their cases and they speak about the government, I've noticed or I've had suspicions that some of these whistleblowers are actually deep state agents who are planted to be whistleblowers to attract whistleblowers. The purpose of that would be to attract whistleblowers to them so that they could gather information on different groups that invite them and things like that. They basically act as a light to moths. And I'm kind of curious if you have these suspicions, and if so, what would be the indicators from your profession that give you pause that someone may be a deep state agent acting, quote unquote, as a whistleblower?
Yeah, that's a fairly involved and sophisticated question. It's a legitimate one. I can tell you that there's some precedent for that concern. When I was at Gap, we had a case regarding the Alyeska oil pipeline. And the company was working with a security company called Wagon Hut. Some of you may have heard of it. Mm-hmm. And I forget whether it was Wagon Hut or another company that actually created a facade, a fake whistleblower organization that was actually, you know, having whistleblowers come in and talk to them as if they were going to help the whistleblower just to get find out what the whistleblowers knew. And that got exposed. So it's actually, you know, it's actually happened. Now, it's hard, you know, it's kind of hard to know, at least quickly, whether a whistleblower or a whistleblower organization that doesn't have a history is legitimate. My ultimate way of determining, not just for whistleblowers and whistleblower organizations, but for, you know, groups like yours and mine and others that we work with, and for individuals, my ultimate way of testing credibility and integrity is to see if they have a history of being on the public record in making some personal commitments and sacrifices and doing, you know, releasing information or taking actions that nobody on the other side of the issue in their right mind would do. because it's, you know, it's too effective in bringing the truth out and endangering the deep state. And in my own view is, unless you, you know, you can find a record for the person you're wondering about of actually making those personal sacrifices and achieving real success on the issue, you know, you're going to have to be cautious.
Yeah, with that, as far as what I've also seen or suspected is that those who've actually served jail time may be deep state operatives, and this is a way of establishing credibility. So I don't know if you've seen that or suspected that.
No, that's a pretty extreme step. I can't speak to that from personal knowledge.
Okay. All right, well, it looks like that was the only question. So, Nick, thank you so much for sharing time with us tonight and keeping us up to speed, and we'll all look forward to hearing the very latest when you make your announcements around the anniversary of the 9/11 events. So thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you all, and I apologize. I have to drop off. I have some deadlines.
Okay. Okay, so that will bring us to our next okay, I'm going to unmute Tony Hall here in one moment, please, if I can find him. Uh-oh. Looks like Tony is probably calling on Skype or something. I don't see him here, so I'll have to unmute everybody again. So, Tony, are you calling in on Skype? Tony Hall, are you with us? Oh, a lot of people are still muted. Okay, I'll show that.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Tony.
I can hear you.
Are you calling in on Skype?
No, I'm not. I'm on a regular phone.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Oh, sure. I can hear you fine. The problem is I can't see you to isolate your microphone on our call list. Somehow you're not showing up, and I suspect it's because you're calling from Canada. We've had issues related to that before. Still, it's rather odd. So I guess we'll just ask everybody to do the same thing again. Please star six your phone so that we don't have background noise while Professor Hall is speaking. And that way everybody will have a chance to hear an important message to us. So with that done, let me just give a brief introduction. I know that most of you don't need it because, first of all, Professor Hall's been on our show before, on our call before. And secondly, he's made such a name for himself in the movement that almost everyone is familiar with him. But he does hold a professorship at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, and he has been under severe attack from Zionist-sponsored forces in the area who are uncomfortable with his outspokenness on issues relating to, for example, 9/11, and also his participation with Kevin Barrett on the False Flag Weekly News, which I personally am addicted to and encourage others to become addicted to and to support. So with that said, we're going to hear the latest. He's been back and forth on this now, having some victories and some losses, and it's become an all-consuming battle for him to maintain the academic freedom that would allow him to pursue his profession. So that is an identified concern of this call, which is censorship at the university level. And so, Dr. Hall, welcome back to the show, to the call, and we look forward to hearing your comments.
Well, thank you very much for hosting me in this, inviting me to speak on this matter. And I've been speaking quite often to Craig McKee. Hi. And and thanks to Cheryl Churcutt particularly. I think she invited me this evening. So let me cut to the chase. It's just before Labor Day. Things are starting to head back. People are starting to head back to campus for the new term. And I will not be teaching courses at the University of Lethbridge. In fact, I am to retire. I'm 67 years old. I will retire formally on October the 20th. And there is no proceedings that have an outcome at the University of Lethbridge, although proceedings have taken place on this academic freedom matter, and I'll describe it. But that's where things have arrived at this moment. And perhaps I can backtrack a little bit and just go back to the period of August 26, 2016, when I was at Jeremy Roth-Kuschel's place with Kevin Barrett. A Facebook post appeared on my Facebook wall, at least that's the story that I've read about at B'nai B'rith Canada, which is part of the Israel lobby in Canada. And a Facebook post, really repulsive Facebook post, said things on my Facebook wall, a post not posted by me, by a person who I do know, but that person says they didn't post it. It's still a mystery what really happened. But that Facebook post indicated that the Holocaust never happened, but it should have. It was a sort of instruction to, quote-unquote, kill all Jews. It was a really repulsive, awful Facebook post, and it was publicized very quickly. And by mid-September, I became aware of what was going on and tried to speak to my university administration. Very quickly, this trial by media built and built, and suddenly I was suspended outside the terms of the collective agreement on October 3rd and 4th. I was supported by the Faculty Association, the University of Lethbridge Faculty Association, and the Canadian Association of University Teachers. There was quite a lot of dismay among the professoriate that the rules of the collective agreement and the recognition of tenure and the whole issue and procedures around academic freedom had kind of been ignored and was essentially declared to be guilty until proven innocent. I was outlawed from stepping foot on the campus. My pay was cut to zero immediately. It was publicized widely. It was a very kind of traumatic period, I have to say. And it carried through until the summer of 2017 when finally we had a court hearing on the nature of this procedure. And the court, I wasn't speaking in the court hearing. It wasn't addressing the issues. The accusations by this point had developed that the things that Dr. Barrett and I say on False Flag Weekly News are reprehensible, are not acceptable, are outside the bounds of what should be permitted in academic discourse. I, you know, never made any qualms about the notion that I'm a university professor in the saddle and that I'm doing my best in a weekly show on the news of the day to comment intelligently on the world as it's unfolding, as we see it, as Kevin and I see it. And of course, if you don't believe the official story of 9/11 and you tend to see false flag terrorism as a sort of repeating fixture in the way geopolitics are organized in the world, you're looking at the world from quite a different angle than many people do. And certainly in the academy, I've noticed I really can't talk to anybody here in Alberta, for instance, any fellow professor, based on the kind of premises and assumptions that we might share in this venue. So So after the court ruled, and the court ruled that the Faculty Association's position was correct and the University of Lethbridge Board's position was incorrect, we went into a kind of period of rapid developments, and I was reinstated onto campus, and the process that we that was going to take place in the Alberta Human Rights Commission, which is, you know, outside the academy and has nothing to do with the collective agreement, there was a procedure set up on campus within the academy. So I was, you know, agreed to go through that process and was reinstated. And there was Benebrith Canada, other organizations like Canadian Jewish and Israel Affairs Committee, CIJA, four organizations raised their voice and said, this is just an abomination that Professor Hall is reinstated on campus. You know, he's such a hater. He's such a disreputable person. I mean, the trial by media was and has been really intense, and it is kind of difficult to go through that. It's, you know, one tries to be as stoic as one can, but it's hard to deal with that. One of the outcomes of that burst of publicity was that the Premier of Alberta, Rachel Notley. Rachel Notley leads a government in Alberta, which is kind of like the Labour Party or social democratic in theory, left-leaning. We've had a sort of one-party state here for about four decades in Alberta, the province of Alberta. But in 2015, Rachel Notley, very attractive, dynamic politician, younger politician, she won a majority, but on November 24th, one day following this burst of bad publicity, she joined with Benebrith Canada to condemn me and call my positions conspiracy theories and indicate I shouldn't be in the classroom and such. So this is a rather a serious matter when the head of the government, we talk about the executive branch in the United States, well, within Alberta there's an executive branch, and the chief executive of that branch, well, actually the Queen is the chief executive, but the person giving advice to the Queen, we do live in a constitutional monarchy here in Canada, in the provinces as well as the federal government. In any case, when the head of government, or the effective head of government, makes a statement about who should be teaching, what should be taught in the universities, what constitute quote-unquote Alberta values. This is a very serious kind of intervention, and it was an intervention taken before any due process whatsoever had taken place. There had been a court ruling saying we had to have some kind of juridical and academic process within the collective agreement at the university, but that hadn't transpired. So how am I doing? I'd like to sort of sum it up in about five more minutes. Is that...
That'll be fine. That'll be fine.
Yeah. So I had imagined that this process, which took place this summer, basically, would be interesting, would be significant, would be a kind of public service, because we really do need some clarification at the universities about what's going on with all these charges of hate speech and anti-Semitism and conspiracy theories and all the censorship that's happening on the internet and all the competing declarations about what constitutes fake news, etc. I had expected that there would be a kind of public and dignified process to discuss this case and discuss what we talk about on False Flag Weekly News, for instance. Of guilt was at the integral to the process. There were secret processes of witnesses giving testimony against me. I couldn't hear what was being said about me, so I couldn't respond. It was a very dramatic violation of what they call procedural fairness. When I heard about all these witnesses giving testimony in secret against me, I asked for a witness, and I asked Graham McQueen, Dr. McQueen, to be a witness for me, and people on this call will be familiar with Dr. McQueen and his work on anthrax and the explosions at Ground Zero, and you know, he's done very specialized work, much lauded by, for instance, David Ray Griffin in his recent book. Professor McQueen wanted to give testimony because one of the things I'm accused of is talking about 9/11 in some kind of unacceptable way. And of course, one of the keys of Dr. Barrett and I, our approach in False Flag Weekly News, is generally we don't buy into the kind of Islamophobia that is, for instance, very prominent in Alex Jones's approach to the issue, although he did really publicize the 9/11 issue. But the view that why do 9/11? It had a lot to do with sort of creating a public environment that would demonize Muslims and make it more possible to invade Muslim countries and sort of divide the population in the way that it's been divided. This is sort of integral to our interpretation. And we do tend to go down the road of, you know, who did it? Not only ask for an investigation, but look at things realistically and say, how likely is such an investigation to happen given the nature of the interests involved in protecting the official story of 9/11 through cover-up. Anyway, Dr. McQueen was going to address all of that, but he was asked to give testimony in secret from me. And he felt this was really an abomination of due process, of natural justice, and I agree, procedural fairness, because, you know, it's pretty important that I know what is being alleged about me and what is being said about me so I can defend myself. I really didn't have an opportunity to bring forward my case. I was put before this committee and gave responses to questions for a few hours, but by that point the committee had been meeting secretly with these witnesses. And so anyway, there was a report and then my responses to that report, and had a kind of peer committee of Graham McQueen and Barry Zwicker and Robin Matthews. These are all professors and a psychologist from San Francisco, Chuck Millar. So I kind of had a committee of elders, of academic elders in a way, that did respond. We followed the process through to the end, didn't get to the final meeting that was in the procedural handbook. So before the process came to an end, I am sort of exiting through this retirement venue. The Faculty Association and the university administration were trying to advance a resigning agenda, that I would resign, and I kind of took a stand. No, I'm retiring. I'm 67 years old. And so there was no outcome of this procedure at the university. There was no finding, as it were. So that's where things lie. And I'll leave it at
that.
Thank you
for that great overview of your history with the university and the struggle. Let's now go into Q&A mode and give everyone who wants an opportunity to ask a question or make a comment.
I'd like to, Ken. I won't be able to get on the queue because I'm
right, moderator. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, thanks. I was muted when you said hi before, Tony, so I was trying to say hi, but I didn't get unmuted fast enough. I guess the first question that comes to me, there are, I'm sure, many things, but why did you decide to retire rather than sort of fight it out to the end? What led you to make that choice?
Oh, Tony's still muted. Hang on a second, Tony.
2 to 4 more years. Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Tony,
yeah, we
I'm
just,
sorry.
Just got you now.
You have to start over. Yeah, sorry.
That there would be 2 to 4 more years. And really, this procedure is not, it's not my case. It's the case of the, you know, because it's a collective agreement, the person who, the entity that carries through the procedures on behalf of the faculty are the faculty association. And so, as I say, we did go through one round. We got to court. I never spoke in the court. We never addressed the substantial issues of, you know, the allegations against me. It was all sort of procedural questions. And so the Faculty Association, you know, have been good to a point. But I have to say that the situation in the academy is pretty dire, that there is a real fear and trepidation among colleagues who have reason to be afraid, who do not want to get into discussions about what constitutes, say, anti-Semitism or conspiracy theory or hate speech. You know, that these are really loaded terms, and people learn in the professional world, in the media, in politics, you know, in all kinds of, you know, high areas where ambitious people, you know, try to make headway, that it's not a good career move to address these issues. We saw with the Left Forum the kind of attitude and prevailing ethos among many colleagues who seem to think that somehow the question of Israel and the Israel lobby in the Western countries and what's happening to Palestinians and how this global war on terror, how the psychology of it is being orchestrated, how this Islamophobia is being sort of propped up and edified and nurtured with you know, media reports and the way our movies and entertainment is presented and on and on and on, that this there's an unwillingness to discuss this at the national level. I mean, I was going to speak on a podium on academic freedom at the University of Saskatchewan. And then 3 days before, this is just before this procedure was to start this summer, there was some kind of secret meeting at the University of Saskatchewan, and the event was called off, and no real credible explanation was given to me. You know, I've never heard from the American Association of University Professors. The situation in the organized professional faculty is, you know, difficult, and it's not unreflective of, you know, a more general situation across society. We all, I'm sure, encounter in our personal lives and professional lives that it's a big step for people in the mainstream to, you know, not only figure out what's going on in terms of the great issues of war and peace and life and death in our time, but take action. And, of course, a recurrent theme is that, you know, the failure of the peace movement, the fact that there's no real credible anti-war movement right now. I mean, one of the diagnoses that can be made is that unless you have a coherent interpretation of who did what to whom on 9/11, on how this global war on terror is actually constructed and what is really going on with this ascendant militarism and surveillance state operations and all of this. And unless you can deal with 9/11 and all the cases of false flag terrorism that come out of that, you can't be effective. And this of course permeates the academy. So anyway, that's my effort to address your question, Craig.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's see. Is anyone else in the queue here to ask a question? Star 6, if you wanted to ask a question or make a comment, star 6. Well, I don't see any others, so, I'm sorry. There's Cheryl who would like to be on, so, and Tom, but I would like to ask you very briefly here, Professor Hall, when do you expect to be back on False Flag Weekly News on a regular basis? Do you know?
Well, there's a little bit of discussion about it, but I think Jeremy Roth-Cushell is doing a fantastic job.
He is.
And Jeremy Roth-Cushell, you know, I quoted him at some length in my presentation to the this investigative panel this summer. Mm-hmm. But I would like to keep my hand in it, and it was, I think, one of the extraordinary experiences of my academic life when Kevin Barrett invited me to replace Jim Fetzer, you know, with whom he'd had a sort of severe ideological disagreement. In 2015, late 2015, I did it for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting how prominent False Flag Weekly News was in the case brought against me. It started in June of 2016 when on the front page of my local hometown newspaper, the Lethbridge Herald, there was a front page story called Conspiracy Theories talking about Professor Hall and this Looney Tune operation called False Flag Weekly News and all the weird things they talk about. So I do believe that False Flag Weekly News is making an impact. I know it was being monitored, and probably I'm being monitored now. But everything, you know, it's an interesting experience to know that you have people out there just, you know, looking for phrases, looking for turns of phrases. They never really want to get into the big picture interpretation questions that you're talking about on that show. I don't have a definitive answer, but thank you very much for asking the question and thinking about it. I certainly think about it.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to see what fate holds in store. Cheryl, you were next, I think, in the queue. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Cheryl,
yeah, okay.
We're actually speaking for the first time in person, I think.
Right. I think so, Tony. Listen, I wanted to thank you for all your courage and strength and fighting that whole ordeal. It must have been really awful. So I just wanted to thank you for your, you know, going through that. And then I also, you know, this is happening to a lot of people. I mean, I've been kicked off a radio show because of the ADL and, you know, some Jewish groups. And Bonnie Faulkner is now off. And what's happened to Jeremy? And then the Left Forum. And I think, and this is more of a comment, I guess, than a question, but maybe you have some thoughts on it. But I think we need to, as a group, come up with some sort of strategies for this kind of situation, because there'll be more of them, you know. And
yeah,
I don't know if you have any.
One of the things that I did in preparation for the work of this investigative panel, I worked from, you know, before Christmas really hard straight through till sort of early May on a 500-page submission that I made to the committee. I don't think they looked at it, and to the extent they used it, they looked at things they could use against me. But I tried to give a history to this type of operation that we're seeing now. It didn't just start, you know, in the last couple of years or last couple of months. For instance, in 2009, I was actually at a conference at York University in Toronto, where I did my MA at York University. Anyway, it was mapping models of the state. It was about, it started as a concept of a one, discussing the future of Israel as possibly a one-state solution rather than imagining a second Palestinian state, maybe some kind of federal entity with, you know, different components in this one state. And the fact that, you know, the putting the capital in Jerusalem and all, I mean, it seems that increasingly it's impossible to imagine with this situation on the ground how a two-state solution is any longer viable. So back in 2009, this was being discussed, and there was a huge opposition to it from B'nai B'rith Canada and from other organizations, including the Jewish Defense League, and there were protests and demonstrations, and it became a real contention concerning academic freedom. And there was a quite stalwart group who just took a stand and said, you know, we're having this conference, we're not backing down, we're not going to give in to this intimidation. And so that was one episode, and it showed the same organizations attacking me now were back then taking the same position, trying to shut down discussion, prevent open debate, rather than you know, coming to the table with whatever position one wants. One of the things that I've insisted on is that we've got to, certainly as senior academics at the university, be very clear that every subject is open for debate and discussion. We can't allow the precedent that we close off certain subjects and just say those are so perfectly interpreted that there's, you know, no improvements possible. Revision and adapting to the times to ask of history questions that seem to speak relevantly to the challenges of our changing circumstances as we move into the future. I mean, this might be called revisionism, and it's essential to what goes on in universities. We have to take a stand. It's really, you know, I'm looking for voices. When I see the issue of academic freedom being discussed in Canada, for instance, I see highlighted Jordan Peterson and controversies there, where the University of Lethbridge case seems to be simply swept to the sidelines, there has been very little real multifaceted discussion from thoughtful people about this particular case. So I'm trying to, you know, generate that kind of interest right now. So one of the things I think we need to do is be clear, what is the history of the Anti-Defamation League? What has it done in the past? What, you know, how is it involved with the intelligence agencies? What is the history of that? What was the history of ADL during the Cold War, during the McCarthy hearings? These are topics that I'd like to continue to study and write about.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, we have two others, but try to keep your questions brief, please. And Dr. Hall, please try to keep the response brief because we're running short on time here. Okay. Sorry. So let's see. Next would be Tom Frieden. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, thank you. And thank you for everything you're doing and have done. My question is really more of a comment. Your case in some ways reminds me of Ernst Lundell's case there in Canada, and it also reminds me of Stephen Jones's case down at BYU, where he was basically bought off with a retirement package, and it just seems like the order of the day.
Let me be clear that there has been no transaction, nothing has been bought, nothing has been sold, that I am a free agent to speak. So when you talk about bought off with a retirement package or something, let me just be clear that that's not a metaphor that applies here. Interestingly, Ernst Zundel, he spent a couple of years in prison in Toronto without any charges against him. Of course, Ernst Zindel was at the center of major trials in Toronto in the mid-1980s, where there was a, you know, very significant hearing on, you know, what was happening during World War II and what was happening at Auschwitz. And, you know, there were records made of two sides presenting, you know, their case, their best case. And eventually he lost the case, but the Supreme Court overruled it because the Constitution of Canada had changed. And we have this, you know, record of this discussion in Toronto, where I grew up. Of course, at the time, I didn't pay any attention to these trials. I heard that Ernst Zindel was a Holocaust denier, a neo-Nazi, a, you know, very bad person, and that was enough for me. I could have easily gone to see those trials, but I wouldn't have even considered it, given the way the media was describing it at the time. But later in the process, after he was kind of kidnapped out of the United States, Ernst Zindel spent 2 years in a Toronto prison cell without any charge against him, and he was one of the first people to be tagged with this security, national security status, sort of indictment without any formal process. And so he was an early person tagged by the global war on terror and the changing laws and the fact that, you know, the principles of innocent till proven guilty you know, had been preempted by this concept of preemptive war, preemptive everything. I felt that the treatment I have been receiving in this process is kind of like the preemptive war idea brought to the university. In other words, I was just suspended. There was no process. There was just an idea, well, we'll have a process somewhere down the line.
We have to keep the answer short, okay? Thank you for the response.
So anyway, that's an idea of what went on with Ernst Zindel.
Okay, PF, please keep it short, and the answer's short. This is the last one. Go ahead, PF. Okay.
I just wanted to say thank you. I mean, Tony, you're extremely admirable and impressive, and thank you.
Okay. That's a nice way to close it out here.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Tony. Oh, that was PF Soto.
Just say your name, so thank you for that very generous remark. And who is saying that? What is the name of the person who said that?
Go ahead, PF. You're back on. Whoops. Hang on. Okay, go ahead, PF. You're back on.
PF Soto.
Mm-hmm.
Say it again, please.
PF as in Paula Francis Soto.
Oh, PF Soto. Thank you so much. That's very generous.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good place to close it out, because I think PF's sentiments reflect all of ours. We appreciate so much, Tony, that you've been in the forefront of this endless battle for freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of academic activity, and we know what a toll that can take on someone. So thank you for all you've done and for sharing time on the call with us tonight.
And I intend to keep this trajectory of articulation and analysis, and I am a retired university professor, so that's my status.
Okay. All right. So now we're free to move on to our third agenda item, and that would be Barbara, again, telling us now about the upcoming events in New York, as soon as I can get us off for Q&A here. So go ahead, Barbara. I'm not able to unmute you, Barbara. Are you muting yourself or what?
I guess I was accidentally
there you go.
Muted.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I'm sorry. Could you repeat what you'd like me to do?
Yes. Well, you were going to update us on plans for the upcoming events in New York, right?
New York and Europe and D.C. and Oakland, California, and cities across the country, yes.
Okay.
So we're ready for that, right?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So do you want me on speakerphone? I believe I'm now on speakerphone. Is it okay?
Sounds okay so far.
Okay, good. Great. All right, so I'll begin with what I think I'll do is I'll do the priority events first as I think of them, and then we'll go down into the kind of second-level events, and there are a lot of those, but there's kind
Barbara, you're starting to break up.
Okay. How about now?
So far, so good.
Okay, maybe I was just a little too far from the phone. Well, just tell me again if there's a problem.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with the main events as they come to mind in order, kind of the high priority events, and then we'll go to the kind of second tier events. And when you see them all together, you'll be very excited about the whole scope of everything. And please don't forget to remind me at the end, because it's a completely related but different category, and that is about the memos, the 9/11 Truth Memos to President Trump project. Because there's really some breaking news about that, okay? And that's really critical because 9/11 Truth, the Lawyers Committee petition, and the Bobby McElwain Act could actually end up in President Trump's address to the nation on September 11th. And I will get to that. That could be a very positive or a very negative breakthrough, depending upon what he says. All right. So anyway, so to the main event, there are two main events, in my opinion, worldwide. They're the Lawyers Committee event in New York City and the Architects and Engineers event in Washington, D.C. So I'll go first to the New York City. On September 10th, Monday, September 10th, now some of you have already heard about this, but others haven't, so I'm going to go into some detail. By the way, I just did send everyone who's on the 9/11 teleconference list the complete overview with all the details, including addresses and photographs for each of the 10 or 11 events and activism demonstrations that are being held in the New York, New Jersey area on September 10th and 11th. So you've all got that for even more detail than I'll give you here. So to the New York City area. So on September 10th, Monday, beginning at 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. This is all in what I just sent you. The Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, whose executive director, Mick Harrison, you just heard earlier in this call, this special guest, the Lawyers Committee will be putting on probably the worldwide main truth event, and it's called 9/11 Truth to 9/11 Justice, Justice for All. And it will be an hour and a half. It will be live streamed. You can watch it live streamed on noliferadio.org. I believe that's all of what I just sent you, but if not, go to www.noliferadio.org at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, or maybe a couple of minutes before, on Monday, September 10th, the day before the anniversary, and you'll watch the whole thing live. So what's going to happen there? What's going to happen there is that Nick Harrison will give about 15-minute overview of where we are legally with the petition project and where we expect to go. And then he and Richard Gage will be there. He's committed. And Mick and Richard Gage and possibly one of our other Lawyers Committee attorneys, but probably just the two of them, will divide between them a summary of the evidence in the petition, calling for a new investigation of World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7 with a special criminal special grand jury. So that will be the first approximate hour of the event. I will announce the other events in the New York City area and around the country for about 5 minutes. And then we will introduce the, at that point we will probably have, if not before, we haven't decided exactly where, but Bob McElwain and Matt Campbell, who are both, 9/11 victims' family members, they will both speak briefly. They're both going to be there. The last part of the program will be a panel of the members of the board of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, of which I'm a board member now, and there will be at least five, if not six of us there. And if there are any comments among the board members, except for Mick, who will have already spoken, and probably Richard Gage will be at the panel as well, I'm sure, and maybe also the 9/11 family members, then we will take Q's and A's from the audience. So it's kind of an exciting event, and what's really exciting about it, besides being live streamed, is that the 9/11 Truth Action Project, known as 9/11 TAP, T-A-P, which is headed nationally by Bill Jacoby, who also is one of our Lawyers Committee board members. Bill Jacoby has organized TAP vigils, either at courthouses or other major public places, on either September 10th, simultaneous with our event, so that it could be live streamed through large screens or smartphones at the vigils around the country. My understanding is there are now 18 cities and towns that are participating across the United States in this. And as we're speaking, Bill Jacoby is holding an organizational meeting, presumably on a teleconference call, with the TAP organizers in these different cities and towns. So that's very exciting. Some of the TAP vigils will be held the next day on September 11th, of course, or both. We do have a flyer for the New York City Lawyers Committee event, which I forgot to send, but I will here in a moment, so that everybody will have that, including Craig and Cheryl and Ken, to send to anyone they can think of that's not already on the list that should have it. And you can print those out as flyers, and you can pass them out anywhere in the country as long as you circle or highlight the information about the live stream on the flyer, even though the flyer is just about our New York City September 10th Lawyers Committee event. That's probably, the other exciting thing about the Lawyers Committee event, and we hope we can pull it off in time. We expect to, but there can always be glitches. But we expect to have an incredible six-page evergreen. It's called Lawyers Committee Newspaper. That will, if everything goes off according to plan, Mick Harrison will have done the final proofing on the digital file, and it will get to the printer in time to be printed and delivered in literally tens of thousands of copies all over New York City. So that's very exciting. Also, we have done an ad, a quarter-page full-color ad, that's already been accepted and paid for. George Capsis, who owns and is the poster of the Western News, in the West Village, where we're holding our September 10th Lawyers Committee event, has agreed to put an ad for our event in their newspaper, the Westview News, which is being circulated around West Village, which is also, I think, known as French Village, and Lower Manhattan starting this Saturday morning. And so there will be an invitation with all the details to our event, the same invitation or ad or flyer that I will send everybody right after this call. So those are the things that I can think about. They're very exciting for the main New York City event and really probably the main worldwide event. The other major event this year for the anniversary period is Architects and Engineers event, which will be in Washington, D.C. On the grass, not the steps this year, but the grassy area between the Capitol Hill, the Capitol Dome and the Reflecting Pool. I believe isn't that on the west side? That's on the side towards the White House. And so that's where they're going to gather at 2 o'clock. And there's an exciting number of speakers there. There will definitely be Richard Gage. There will definitely be Mick Harrison speaking on behalf of the Lawyers Committee. There will definitely be Bob McLean. There will definitely be Cynthia McKinney. There will definitely be Lionel, whose last name I frankly don't know. But if I don't know if some of you are aware, but Lionel, believe it or not, was just in the Oval Office last Thursday or Friday, I think Thursday, with his wife standing right behind Trump. And there's a big picture on the Internet of the three of them right behind Trump's desk in the Oval Office. So Lionel is a 9/11 truth person who was the keynote speaker at the main 9/11 truth event in New York City about 3 years ago. So things are happening. I think it's probably the time, even though I can go into other events in New York City and around the country and in Europe, which I now know about. Yesterday we had the TAP for the Truth Action Project Europe call, and I can fill you in on some of those exciting events. And they're trying to coordinate them with the live streams of both the September 10th Lawyers Committee event and the live stream also of the Washington, D.C. event. So Richard Gage's event in Washington, D.C. starts at 2 o'clock. I believe it goes to 3 o'clock or 3:30. I think they have a permit from 1 to 3, but they're formally starting at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on September 11th. There are other speakers there I can't remember, but I will send you also the flyer, the official Architects and Engineers flyer for that event. It'll have all of the speakers on it, but those are the main ones I can think of. I do know that Oscar, who's a major 9/11 researcher and activist down in Argentina, will be there. So that's kind of exciting for Washington, D.C. It'll also be live stream starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on September 11th on No Lights Radio. Also, right after that, nolightsradio.org, Alan Reese will be live streaming it's called the 9/11 Truth or the 9/11 Film Festival out of the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California, here in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area. And that's exciting. The Lawyers Committee will have about a 15-minute presentation there. It's the film, I believe, by Ed Asner that everybody probably already knows about. It's been out for about a year. And so that's also going to be the entire thing, including all of the films. You'll be able to watch live streamed. I believe that's beginning at 3 p.m., it's either 1 or 3 p.m. West Coast time on September 11th. But that is also going to be in what I send you right after this call. So you'll have the precise start time. And I've also just a moment ago sent everybody on the list that is called Alan Reese's email just a few minutes ago, in which he gives the link to all three of those live streams when the time comes to watch them live stream. So you already have all that. All right. So I think what I should do now is give a brief overview of what I know, which is a lot, about the project that Robert David Steele put together starting about 2 months ago, kind of a brilliant project. Some of you may know about it, some of you may not. He calls it the 9/11 Truths or 9/11 Memos to President Trump project. And so starting about 2 months ago, he reached out to, it wasn't a voluntary process. He invited individuals from the 9/11 Truth Movement, who he considered leaders, to do he asked for a one-page memo. Some of the memos are up to 4 pages that he accepted. He was like the editor. He determined who was going to be accepted, who was going to be invited, and whose would be accepted after they submitted them. Anyway, there are now about 26, 27 of them that have been accepted. He's closed that out, at least for this round. And he has made a book of them. And I think I've already sent it, but I'll send it again after this call, the link online to every single one of the memos, including his cover memo. And the exciting thing is that two days ago, Robert David Steele sent an email to all of us who participated in the Memos Project. And by the way, that includes myself and Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott and many people. There's also Andrew Krieg from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, in addition to myself from the Lawyers Committee, and a whole list of people that you will recognize, a few that you won't, I didn't, who submitted these memos. That's the upside of the memos. Oh, by the way, they were, according to Robert David Steele, he has 5 sources who personally know, or 5 delivery methods or vectors that he personally knows, including Roger Stone and Trump's former national security advisor in the White House in the campaign, Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn, and 3 others that he claims, all 5 of them, he had confirmations from 2, including Roger Stone, did get into the West Wing of the White House. Whether they have gotten to Trump, he does not know. He does not know whether Kelly blocked them, his chief of staff. He still does not have confirmation that Trump has them, but he believes he does. And the reason he believes he does is that two nights ago, we all got, the 26 or 27 of us, got an email from Robert David Steele telling us that he had just received word that he was about to get significant funding for his project, and that he was told in the near future was going to be meeting with the speech writers and top assistants to the president to try to lobby them to get two paragraphs into President Trump's speech to the nation on September 11th. And I will send those two paragraphs to you. I can't really send you, I don't feel that I'm free to send you Robert David Steele's whole email, but that's not what matters. What matters are the two paragraphs he's going to try to get into Trump's speech on 9/11. And those two paragraphs basically say, Mr. President, you promised to tell him to get to the truth of 9/11, especially at the World Trade Center, to the American public. We want you to keep your promise. And these are the two main things we want you to do now. Before the election, we want you to support the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry Call for the Special Criminal Grand Jury with the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. And we want you to get to every single member of Congress through your White House Congressional Liaison Office to get them all to support the Bobby McElvain Act calling for a new investigation of the World Trade Center 1-7 attack. So if this were possibly to happen without anything else he might say that could ruin it, which could always happen because he ad-libs, it would truly be a major breakthrough. Okay? So those are the three big things I can think of. If you'd like me to go on, I can tell you about the kind of second-tier events. I have sent you...
Barbara, we really don't have time for that, but if you can send the links to that to Craig, we can put it in the minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Barbara. I trust that no one has any further questions of Barbara, but we'll give you just a moment if you do need some clarification on anything she said. So if anybody has anything to ask, just blurt it out. Okay, well then sounds like Barbara. Okay, go ahead.
Somebody?
I just wanted to announce myself. I'm here, Mike Cook.
Oh, hi. Okay. Okay, so Barbara, thank you for that big rundown and for keeping us up to speed with what's going to be happening next month. And let's hope that a lot of folks who can't participate for reasons of distance choose to tune into the live stream, which I trust for one donation at No Lies Radio they can access, right? Any donation of any size.
No. If you watch the live stream, it's free.
Oh,
if you
okay.
watch the live stream, it's free. However, if you watch over the next 10 days, the request is for at least a $1 donation, and then you're able to see it for free for 10 days.
To access the archives. Okay, fair enough. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you again, Barbara. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so we're moving on to our last agenda item, and that would be Wayne Costey's response to Craig from the previous meeting. So, Wayne, you have the floor. I think everybody's still on mute, huh? I wonder why that happened.
Hello, Craig. Can you hear me?
Yep, can hear you now. Go ahead.
Yep. Okay, so at the last meeting, I committed to going back and looking at the archives to see where, because I had said that Craig had frequently apologized for not having additional evidence, but evidence about what happened at the Pentagon. And if you recall, I objected at the time to not being allowed to define what evidence meant. I objected to not being able to respond to Craig's assertion that I claim that I am part of a disinformation campaign. But I do have a reply. Actually, my reply is actually fairly extensive. I actually created an entire website to answer this, and you can go see my reply at truthandshadows.net.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And, yeah, Thank you very much. And if you go to truthandshadows.net, you'll see the section that says Wayne's reply to Craig, in which you will see the phrase, in which it has, I hereby apologize to Craig for making the above statement. But it goes through and answers a lot of the questions about what evidence is and the statement about me being part of a disinformation campaign. So I hope that closes this agenda item because I think we're done.
Well, if I may, although I certainly want to give Craig an opportunity to speak to this, but my understanding was that he was requesting of you that you would send a retraction for that comment to whoever you sent the original message to or provide proof of your allegation. So are you willing to are you unable to either of those? Or do you feel like either of them has been done on your website or what?
I've actually sent a retraction email just now for the apology email, pointing out the additional information that's available on truthandshadows.net. Yes.
Okay. All right. So that means that essentially what we have here is a retraction. Craig, did you want to respond at all?
Yes. One of the things I requested was to know who the people were who were BCC'd the first time so that I could confirm that they had received whatever apology was going to go out. Are you going to provide? So I'm not going to give the floor back just yet. So that is the first thing that I am asking for. Second of all, you didn't even say what you were apologizing for. You didn't explain what it was you were apologizing for. We spent most of your remarks were talking about things that were unrelated to the apology. I also want to point out that creating a website, truthandshadows.net, is just about one of the most unethical things I can imagine you doing. That's just a total cheap shot. I don't know what to say to that. I mean, why can't you just make up some other name? You have to try to mirror the name of my site? I mean, that's just unbelievable. Those are my initial remarks. I would like the opportunity to come back and follow up depending on what you say to those.
Okay, did you get all three of those responses, Wayne? Are there questions?
I'm not going to reply as to who got it because they were on the list of the original email they sent me that was forwarded to me. So just go find the email that I responded to, and you'll see the people that it got sent to. They are the ones that received it.
Okay.
And so that's up to you. If you really want to go find it, I can give you the date of when it came in. If you'd like that, right? Is that what you need?
I know the dates. I know the dates.
Well,
but
then go find out.
It's a little unclear to me why a discussion with 43 CCs on it would be turned into 43 BCCs. But if you're telling me it's the same 43 people, then yeah, I would like to be included. If you're going to email all those people, I would like to be included in that email.
Well, they're still BCC'd. It's a courtesy, in sending out large emails that it's appropriate to use BCCs. And so that's what I did.
Even though you took those from a discussion that was all CC'd.
So the list is available to Craig through an earlier email. What about the nature of the apology that he's asking about, Wayne? What did that say you're apologizing for?
Do you want me to go through and read from the website? You know, basically.
No, I just want you to clarify what you stated in your email you were apologizing for.
I criticized Craig said that he frequently apologizes for not having any evidence. And of course, it's an undefined term. And do you want me to dig into the teleconference recordings? And that's what Craig objected to.
You said that you had emailed an apology to the people on the BCC list, and I'm just asking what was it that you were apologizing for? Just summarize it. You don't have to get into
the details. For frequently for frequently have acute for saying that Craig frequently apologized for not having any evidence.
Okay, but that's what I need to know. Okay, thank you. So
that's false. You're admitting that was false?
I apologize for having said that. I can't find anything in the recordings because you rarely talk about evidence. You always criticize other people for stuff, but you never talk about evidence.
You're apologizing for having made the remark, which is what was basically requested. So then the third thing was...
Well, a retraction and an apology was requested, and it sounds like he's giving an apology without a retraction.
Well, okay.
That's semantics.
So, okay.
That's semantics.
So what about
you want me to send another email? I'll put another email out saying I retract what I said instead of just apologizing for it. What would you like me to do, Craig?
Well, first of all, your email makes a false statement when you say that I said that you were part of a disinformation campaign. I've made very clear every time I've mentioned this that I think a disinformation campaign has been going on for more than 10 years, and some people who are involved in it are involved inadvertently. They're not necessarily being dishonest, but they've
Craig,
been...
Craig, excuse me for cutting you off, but this is off the question, okay? We're really just...
Well, it's part of his email, though.
Well, then you would have to raise it as a separate concern because that's really not part of what we're doing here is just staying within the framework of the original request for retraction and or apology and, create his response to that. We can't get into side questions at this time, okay?
Well,
Craig, just go say Wayne is a disinfo on the website, truthandshadows.net.
It does not say that.
Wayne, is it? Go to the website. There's a tab. Wayne is a disinfo. And go read the email that you sent. And you can twist the words you want.
I know what's in the email.
I know.
I never. Are you telling me that I use the words Wayne is a disinfo? Are you telling me that that's a direct quote?
No. But.
Course then. You just implied it was a direct quote, and now you're saying it's not a direct quote.
No. He said that's the name of his web page or whatever. You didn't say you said that.
Go read it.
So let's stay back on the subject. Yeah, back on the subject here. So, Wayne, you're willing to send another email using the word retraction to satisfy the original request from Craig. And then Craig already has available to him the list of the people to whom it's being sent, according to your report. And then I think that resolves it for the time being. I don't think we need to belabor this, okay? So thank you,
Wayne.
Well,
resolved at all.
Okay, Craig, what do you want to say?
Well, look, I don't want to take everybody's time either on this. You know, I really wish that we weren't discussing it in the first place. But, you know, it was very simple. He made a statement, and the statement was false. He won't even admit that the statement was false. He says, I apologize, and here's my website, talking all about Craig McKee.
He says he's willing to send out a retraction, Craig, and I think that that's what you requested. So I think we have to accept that as a fulfillment of your request.
Well, before I would accept that, I would need to know what it was before it went out, you know. That's really what should have happened here. We should have had this discussion, and then an email should have gone out. It shouldn't have gone out beforehand. So...
Sorry, I've done what I've done. I'm not doing any more related to this. I'm not sending out a retraction because an apology isn't a retraction. And I'll change it. And I'll change the word so it says retraction. Is that what you like? I can do a second email.
Look, I don't even know what's in the first email yet, so I'm not going to tell you to do a second email until I know what's in the first one and in the second one.
Oh,
well, you can discuss it another time then. We're done with tonight's agenda item, please.
I'd like to make a comment, if I may.
One moment, though. Let me just say to Rain that while I agree with him to the gist of what he's just said, that I do think that he ought to have included Craig in the original email after all. And if he did not, then he really does need to include him at some round to let him know what is being put out in request to his response. It's only reasonable. Okay, so go ahead, Cheryl.
I just want to say that Wayne, you put out the false information about Craig in the first place, and he deserves an apology for that. And in a nice, your tone and your spirit about it is really negative and even aggressive. by creating a website like his to make your points. I don't know. It just feels really, really ugly to me. And that's all I have to say about it. I just think it's ugly, and I think you might want to think about all of that.
Well, Cheryl, let me just simply say that as a licensed professional therapist, you should have known how it is to be accused of something and not being able to respond. This, when I tried to complain about the framing of this last month, I wasn't allowed to. So I'd like to end the agenda item now.
Well, I'm not sure that you have that option.
Right.
He has the option to propose ending the agenda item now. If anybody objects to ending the agenda item now, I guess it's been proposed that we end this discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Discussion.
Aye.
Aye.
Yeah,
discussion.
All opposed.
Wait a minute.
Nay.
We've had no discussion.
Opposed.
Oh, you're right. You're right. That is a debatable point. You're right, Craig. Okay, so it is a debatable point. Who would like to speak? So I guess we have to give Wayne the first opportunity to speak because he's proposing it. So Wayne, you have the floor. Why do you think we should end it now? And then we'll hear from somebody opposed and go back and forth until we are ready to vote. Go ahead, Wayne.
Because I think this will go on for a very long time, and I don't think it'll get anywhere. And we need cooler heads to figure out what the next steps might be. Over.
Okay. Would anyone like to speak against the motion to end the discussion?
I would, Barbara.
Barbara, go ahead.
Great.
Yes, I feel very strongly that what Wayne has done is worse than what we have removed someone from this call for. I really do. I think it's reprehensible. I think it's transparent. Attempt to smear Craig. And he's using semantics to try to weasel. I don't know if anybody else is interested in removing Wayne from this call.
It's out of order. It's an out of order request because we're dealing with it now as a question of ending discussion. If we return to the discussion, you can raise that issue. Okay. Who would like to speak in favor of ending the discussion? Would anybody else like to speak against ending the discussion?
Craig.
Craig, go ahead.
I just don't think anybody, I don't think that Wayne has the right to, he's the one that's being asked to make an apology, and I don't think it's up to him when we finish discussing this. He's actually compounded the whole problem by making another false statement on the call tonight. No, I don't think he should be able to cut off discussion prematurely.
All right. So does anybody else want to speak in favor of the motion to end the discussion? Hearing none, then we'll take another voice vote. All in favor of ending the discussion, say aye.
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 All
aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Aye.
Nay.
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 I think the nays have it, so the discussion is still open. Who else would like to speak who has not spoken yet?
I think you need to clarify the question as to whether you're proposing never to discuss it again, even in the future, or just on this call.
On this call. It would have to be reintroduced, though, to be raised on a future call. Okay, but to end it on this call. The motion is to end the discussion for this evening. And then it would not automatically be raised in a future call unless somebody requested it that it be reintroduced. Okay.
If that wasn't clear,
okay. I'm sorry. Yes. Please go ahead. Whoever said they wanted to speak.
Yeah, because we seem to have voted not to end the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is Tony Hall. And,
yes, Tony.
Yes, and I'm curious to ask Wayne. I agree with Craig. It's a very sketchy decision to open a website with the same name as Craig's website. I was wondering if I could ask Wayne, what would make him do that? Why would he think that would be an appropriate thing to do?
Wayne?
Well, Tony, you know, that's actually a very good question. The first one is to kind of get a reaction from Craig, which I guess we've done. Secondly, it brings out my premise, which is the lead in to this, is that it's truth without the shadows. Secondly, it's a bargaining chip because I actually was expecting Craig to complain about it, and I have an offer that's a heads he wins, tails I lose. I'll take it. I'll take down truthandshadows.net. But that hasn't come up yet, so I'll postpone that. But it's basically to spark a dialogue, and so that's it. And it has a lot of, the website's got a lot of good information, and it raises a lot of questions, has a lot of content from Craig. And I have actually transcribed an entire interview done by Cheryl and Craig last in January. I've got the entire thing transcribed, and I have comments on it that are, you can go see my reply to the misstatements that Craig has made on during the interview.
It's a bargaining chip. What do you want to bargain? What are you demanding or something that you feel you could achieve by replicating his website's name and thus putting him in an awkward position and getting something from him? What do you want to bargain for?
Am I supposed to be negotiating with you, Tony? I'll gladly tell you.
Tony's just asking the clarifying question there, which is a reasonable question. If it's a bargaining chip, but what do you hope to gain from it? What is it that you're seeking?
So I would make the offer to Craig that I would take down the, I would abandon the URL, truthandshadows.net, mm-hmm. In exchange for him coming back at the next teleconference and telling me where in any of the CIT videos Lloyd England points to the large poll and says, gosh, that's the guy that came into my windshield. Because he claims that. That's a statement of fact that he completely makes, and it's entirely erroneous. If he comes back and says that he can find it and shows me where it is, I'll take it down. If he comes back and says I can't find it, it doesn't exist, I'll take it down. I'll take truthandshadows.net down under those conditions. Heads he wins, tails I lose.
Wayne, is that really how we want to be doing business with each other?
Well, since we can't seem to negotiate anything else except slander, sure. Bring back to the next teleconference the facts that he says are central to his arguments, which don't exist.
Who's slandering who, Wayne?
Excuse me?
Who's slandering who? You have slandered Craig.
Craig has called me a part of a disinformation campaign. He doesn't use the word. He says it's a disinformation campaign, and then in later paragraphs it says I'm part of it. So I did not. Go read. Wayne is a disinfo on our website.
Okay.
It's your email.
This is taking us outside of the aegis of the existing issue, which is about the statement. Alleging a statement by Craig that Craig is arguing was false and asking for a retraction from. So my understanding is that the resolution would be that Wayne offers the retraction to the original list, which is what Craig requested. It sounds like Wayne is willing to do that. However, the question comes up as to whether or not Craig ought to be given some vetting option there. So that's the part I'm not clear about. But the rest of it seems to me that should be the resolution for this as far as we can take it tonight, because that's the only thing on the table right now is the question of retraction versus providing supporting evidence. So, Wayne, would you, in order to allow us to move forward, be willing to send to Craig the retraction language that you're willing to send to the list to make sure that it satisfies his understanding of what a retraction would mean?
Well, it'll be my second email to the group, but sure, I'll work with something, and it'll be about three sentences. Yep. I think so.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait until next month to find out whether this is a satisfactory resolution or not.
Can I speak to this before
yeah.
we close?
Sure.
I want to know what both emails say, because you've already sent one of them out.
You got a copy of it.
I do. Okay. Well, that's a start.
Well, you get a copy of everything I sent out to the BCC list.
Right.
You know,
okay.
You, if you've got it from me, that's where it comes from.
All right, then. Now, this is not necessarily a statement to Wayne. It's more a statement perhaps to Ken. But what do I do about statements that have been made in Wayne's comments tonight that are false? What do I do about that? Because
well,
it's off top. He made it off top. He made the comments, and I'm not allowed to respond to them, even though they are no more off topic than the original comment I'm responding to.
Well, I'm not sure that they weren't off topic, but if you believe, you know, Wayne is making a false topic, you can certainly raise it next month as a challenge to Wayne and take it from there. But it would be a different issue, not a question of apologizing for the initial erroneous statement.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with that because in his presentation, he's made statements that are false, and in comments on the presentation, I don't quite understand why I would not be able to comment on those since they're part of his presentation.
He made statements that are false with respect to this question of retraction or proof of your original statement or something else?
Something else.
Well, I guess, you know what, Craig, you can challenge my ruling on that, and then we can put it to a vote and then let people decide whether or not you should be able to extend the discussion to cover that question or not, okay? Because, you know, I think that's the only fair way to deal with this. I don't want to be in the middle, okay? So why don't you just challenge my ruling, and I'll you know, we'll have a discussion on it and put it to a vote, and then decide whether people want to hear more on that question or not, okay?
Well, I don't want to put everybody through a big, long discussion. I just feel there are two statements of fact that have been made that are false. So, you know, I'm in a tough spot myself here because, you know, everybody probably wants to get to the announcements and get off the phone, and you know, I don't really want to be an obstacle to that. But at the same time, I don't want the false statement of last month to be compounded by two new ones this month. So, you know, it kind of puts me in a tough spot there. So, yes, I'm going to challenge the ruling, and I have no choice.
Okay. So the ruling has been challenged about keeping questions not pertinent to the immediate question off the table. Craig is asking that we do allow some discussion of those questions. So would anybody – Craig, you're the maker of the well, wait a minute. This is a challenge of the ruling of the chair, so I guess there isn't I don't think there is discussion on that. This is just an up and down vote. So all in favor of support? I think it has to go this way. Those supporting the ruling of keeping this discussion limited to the existing question, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Okay, so this is a question of whether or not you support the ruling that this other question is out of order, is off the subject, okay, which is what I told Craig. So if you support that decision, you say aye. If you oppose that decision and you believe we should be able to discuss these other subjects, you say nay, okay? So all in favor of supporting the ruling, say aye.
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 Okay. All opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Wow.
Three
That's
people?
That's a lot of votes.
There are a lot of abstentions. I think there are a lot of abstentions.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. I heard about two to three people say yes and one person say no.
I think a lot of people are muted. This is Cheryl. I say nay.
Okay. Let me check the roster here and see if anybody's muted. Oh, there are a couple of mutes. Let's unmute. But I can't unmute because they're self-muted. So Tom Tweeden and Malcolm Arnold, you're both on mute. So
I'll say nay. I'll say nay also.
Star 6 if you want to unmute yourself. Okay, there's Malcolm back. And Tom, if you want to vote, star 6. There you go. Okay. So now nobody's muted.
Yeah. Malcolm Arnold, I think that if the one party feels that they've been wrong here tonight,
they should be able to address that. So I don't know how that vote goes.
Well, this is
I don't know anything about this subject.
Yeah, well, I'll clarify once again what the votes mean, okay? So Craig's challenges to off-topic comments by Wayne have been ruled out of order by the chair, by the facilitator. And so we're just voting, and Craig has challenged that decision, so we're just voting as to whether or not to support the existing ruling, which is that it's off-limits for this discussion, or by opposing that ruling to allow for that discussion, okay? So if you're in favor of keeping the discussion limited to the topic at hand, you say aye. If you're in favor of broadening it to the other topics that Craig would like to discuss, you say nay, okay? So all in favor of supporting the ruling of the chair, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
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 Okay,
nay.
The nays have it. So the ruling of the chair has been overturned, and we will now give Craig the floor to continue his discussion. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, there are two points, so it's not a big deal. But it's the comment that Wayne has made about me calling him a disinformation person. In the email, and I don't have it in front of my nose here, but I do refer to there being a disinformation campaign. And then I do talk about Wayne in the same email, but I do not say that Wayne is deliberately part of a disinformation campaign. I make the point anytime I talk about this that some people can be in agreement with this position and quite innocently, and they aren't necessarily disinformation peddlers, but I'm saying somebody is. Okay, so that is false in what he's saying, especially having a heading, Wayne is a disinfo. It couldn't be more of a distortion. The second point I wanted to refer to is he made reference to the Lloyd England thing. Now, what I have always stated is that Lloyd England is very clear, and you can hear it on multiple recordings, that he says it was the long end of the pole that he and this silent stranger pulled out of the cab and set down on the road. He said it was the long end of the pole, the part that was attached to the ground. Now, to my knowledge, I have never said that England pointed specifically at the one in the photographs and said, that's the pole I'm talking about. So if I ever implied that he had specifically identified pole number one, then that would be an error on my part, but I don't believe I've done that. If I have, it's an error. But what I'm very clear on is that he said it was the long end of the pole, not the top part of pole two, as Wayne would have us believe. So those are the two false statements.
So, Craig, just bring your clips to the next teleconference. Glad to abandon truthandshadows.net if you do.
Yeah, well, that's a you know, that's like blackmail. So you know what you can do with that suggestion.
Yeah, I'll
that's
keep
extortion.
The I'll keep
extortion. It's extortion.
I'm just demanding truth, not the shadows.
No, you're not. You're demanding that he lie.
I'm demanding that he show what he says happened in those CIT videos. I can't find the phrase that he's talking about. I'd love to see it. So, Craig, if that's extortion, well, you know, I think I'm just demanding the truth without the shadows.
Oh, yeah, we get the clever remarks about shadows. We've heard that, what, 4 or 5 times now? I think you've made your point on that. You're very clever.
Okay,
you've been well schooled, Wayne.
And if you want to call me part of a disinformation campaign, don't put them in the same emails. Don't even apply that the people who support a large plane impact are in fact disinfo people, because the evidence is on that side. You have nothing to support anything else. No explosives, no flyover, no nothing.
Okay,
that's a false statement. Hold it.
We can only have one person speaking at a time, and I'm going to take the floor back. So it sounds like we're really, once again, jumping off onto other tangents. So I'm going to ask that we maintain some reference to the point at hand. Again, the request, the original request from Craig was for a retraction of Wayne's allegation. Wayne says he's willing to use the term retraction in a new email to the closed list and send copy to Craig. So I hope that we can leave the discussion there. Craig has been given an opportunity to clarify some off-topic comments made by Wayne. Hopefully that will suffice for this evening. Does anybody else feel a need to pursue this discussion further tonight? Okay, well, hearing none, then we'll close the discussion. If anybody wishes to revisit this issue based
point,
on...
Point of clarification, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Malcolm Arnold, so I'm coming into this. I have no idea the facts of this at all. So I'm kind of curious as to... what I'm gathering is that there was emails that were sent that were CC'd, and then they were CC'd, and then they were BCC'd, and that was on a closed list. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And the statement was made that Craig had frequently apologized for not having evidence on the teleconference, to which he objected. And the idea was that Wayne was to come back today with either proof of his allegation or a willingness to retract, and he is saying he's willing to retract it. So I think
my question is that if you create a website that then is available to anybody in the entire world, then it seems to me that it is taking a conflict that is localized, a potential conflict, right, because it may be potential, whatever, conflict that is localized and then globalizes it. And I that's the way it seems to me, and I'm not sure if other people see it that way or if the participants see it that way.
Well, that's certainly what it is, but people do that all the time. That's where websites often come from. They come from conflicts that people feel need to be given a greater audience or whatever, you know. So that's
and this is the first time for conflict resolution within the closed group before there was a public website made.
That may be true.
No, this is the second time. I was not able to respond to any of the other allegations.
False.
I was only allowed under the rules.
Wayne's correct. I called Wayne out of order last call. That's what he's referring to, Craig. That's what he's referring to.
Yeah, but he's mischaracterizing it by saying that he was not allowed to respond to allegations. I mean,
That's how it was.
Being out of order is not the same thing. He was off topic. That's why he was ruled off topic.
Yeah,
from the very specific
things. Okay.
Well,
from the so again, I'd like to go back to the main question here about whether we should end this discussion. So, does anybody feel a need other than does anyone else feel a need to pursue this discussion further tonight?
I think this is Cheryl. I think it needs to be pursued, but maybe not tonight, but maybe a little bit at the next meeting or something.
Craig, Cheryl, would you like to make a motion to postpone discussion till the next meeting?
Yes, I'll do that. I make a motion that we postpone till the next meeting.
Okay, is there a second to the motion?
I second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to postpone discussion of this topic till the next teleconference. Any discussion?
Yeah, this is Wayne. The discussion is that continuing this very same strict, narrow guidelines that we've started this under, or is it going to be or are we just terminating this topic and another one may arise? That's my question.
I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to the question. I don't really maybe Cheryl would like to clarify what she has in mind with the motion. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, I think one thing is it's late right now, and most people probably just want to get off the call. And I feel like maybe people would like to think about this a little bit and see what more there is to say next time. I actually would like to pursue Barbara's suggestion that maybe Wayne not be allowed on the call anymore.
That would definitely be a whole different agenda item. That couldn't be a continuation of this discussion. That would have to be a different
a different
Cheryl,
one.
Let's, Cheryl, let Ma- you and Ma- I talk about putting it on the agenda next time.
Yeah, you
okay.
Guys can put anything
this is Malcolm Arnold.
Malcolm.
So I don't know any of the facts here, but there's obviously been an email sent out that one participant has not been able to read. There's also been a website that's been put up that not everybody, I think, within the closed group has had a chance to read. I mean, I'm fine with not reading it because I don't know the history of the whole thing. But it seems like from the participation of the other participants here that they haven't seen this website yet. And so considering that it affects a group and stuff like that, I think that it needs to be discussed again because it's been made public outside the group. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, so I guess we could say anything relevant to tonight's discussion could be pursued next week if we agree to postpone discussion. We could pick it up where we left it off and discuss any relevant developments. I guess, is that fair, a summary, Cheryl, of what you have in mind?
Yeah, I think so, and I think Malcolm's points were good. And also, I think, you know, it's one thing to retract and apologize, but if you do it in a really aggressive way by creating sort of a mocking website or, you know, criticizing the same person that you're supposedly apologizing to, it doesn't feel like a genuine
okay.
retraction or,
right.
or apology. So, yes.
Okay. So that's the understanding of what we're voting on here is whether to postpone this discussion until next week and pick up these threads as relevant. Okay. So all in favor of postponement of this question until next month's teleconference, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Okay, the ayes have it. So we will put this on the agenda for the next teleconference and resume discussion. And now we're ready for announcements. So I would like to begin, and if you have an announcement, just hold your horses just a second, because I have a few that I really need to put out there. The first is that I need to note with deep regret the passing of Dan Barnum from this earthly sphere. Dan Barnum was the most illustrious member of our Houston 9/11 Truth Movement. He was a well-known architect and member, star member of the Architects and Engineers on their board, et cetera, was very, very much the spearhead in trying to get the National Architects Organization to sponsor a call for a new investigation. So he will be dearly missed, and I just wanted to note that for everyone's reference. And AE 9/11 Truth has put up a nice tribute page for him, if you care to look at that. And then secondly, I think I need to make an overdue shout out just general appreciation to both Cheryl, who has really stepped up to the plate and really done a stellar job of organizing our calls. We wouldn't be doing this anymore if she hadn't been willing to do that. And to Craig for his tireless efforts to keep us informed of what has happened on the teleconferences and to create an archive, or not to create an archive, but to allow us to archive, some very clear minutes as to what transpires here. So to both of them, my teammates, I would just want to say thank you for all you do, and I pray that you'll keep on doing it. And now, other announcements? Any?
Craig, I have one, Ken.
Okay, go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I don't know if people are aware of this, but they're in the ever-ramping up censorship that's happening online, there were two more websites, and I'm probably other people have other examples they know about, but the two that I've heard about, websites that have been pulled down by WordPress, which, a lot of people have their sites on WordPress, including me. And one of them is it used to be Willie Loman was the name of the pseudonym, the guy named Scott Creighton, but it's now called AmericanEveryman.com, and his site's been I guess it's kind of similar. It just talks about different conspiracy type stuff and false flags, and his site was taken down after 11 years without any warning and without any opportunity for him to export his material. So he's trying to appeal that right now, and he's obviously quite upset about what happened. And also Ken Dock, who I have had disagreements with in the past, but nevertheless, his site was also pulled down by WordPress. The only difference being that they gave him a limited time to export his material to so that it could be put up somewhere else. I have no idea if he's done that or not. But those are two, you know, these aren't big websites. These aren't ones like Alex Jones or these are just kind of regular people that do their own thing. And I related to it very closely. And so I just thought people should be aware that this is happening. That now WordPress is doing this on its own.
Who owns WordPress? Okay, thank you, Craig. We just need to keep track of this because the repression is increasing. There's no question about the increasing censorship on all these different platforms. So, yeah. Who else would like to make an announcement?
I have an announcement. Barb, it doesn't have
Barb,
to be now.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I want to, and this also, I think there's one more agenda item at the end, and that's always to talk about the next call and the one after, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so either for the next call or the one after, it doesn't really matter. I think the next call will be after September 11th anyway, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, 26th. Mm-hmm.
On the 26th, yeah, September. So the announcement is, or the revelation, is that recently a man by the name of Robert Alexander, who is a grandfather now, I think he's a pretty young grandfather, but a man by the name of Robert Alexander, as many people do, got in touch with the Lawyers Committee through our website. And he was directed or somehow got to Jane Clark, who is the president, was the president. By the way, everyone needs to know that Jane Clark has resigned from the board and the presidency of the Lawyers Committee. So as of now, I meant to mention that, David Meischwinkel, who's a great guy, a wonderful attorney in New Jersey, former Marine officer or Army officer, and a former New Jersey policeman, and now he's an attorney. He's a criminal defense attorney, interestingly. But Dave Meischwinkel is our acting president, and we are looking for ideas for who could be a very high-profile, pro-9/11, passionate pro-9/11 truth new president, by the way. So if you have any ideas, please let me know. That's not the announcement. So the announcement is that onto the Lawyers Committee website, I would say now about 5 weeks ago, maybe six at the most, time is flying, a man by the name of Robert Alexander, goes by Bob Alexander, contacted the Lawyers Committee somehow got to Jane Clark. Jane Clark had a long interaction with him and encouraged him to do a sworn juried affidavit of his experience. I'm going to send you that sworn juried affidavit. And I'm going to send you the photographs that go with it. He is now sworn, but I'm about to tell you, under penalty of perjury, and I recommend him for a future call. And this is what he said in a nutshell. In January of 2000, into his place of business in the San Diego area, came together Prince Bandar and one of the alleged 9/11 hijackers in the 28 pages, Nawaf al-Hazmi. Okay, this is huge. And his sworn juried affidavit is now in the hands, through Terry Strada, who is the chairwoman of the 9/11 families group that really pushed for release of 28 pages and the passage of JASTA, as you know. Terry Strada personally, she was so moved by this, she personally got it to the Motley Rice Law Firm. Now, when you see this 11-page single-spaced sworn juried affidavit under penalty of perjury, you'd better be sitting down when you read it. Okay?
Okay. Note taken, and we'll...
And, can
yeah,
speaking, I just wanted to let people know, for next month, we already have Xander Arena is going to be speaking about the Las Vegas false flag event, and then we have Lawrence Fine will be speaking about 9/11 in some way.
Right. And then we'll have also the continuation of the discussion from tonight, Rusty McKee. And so, yeah, we'll have to see what we have in time available. But, yeah, so, okay. So what Barbara's suggestion should be, taken under advisement, and we can go from there. Okay. And any other announcements?
I have an announcement as far as it talks about films. Malcolm Arnold. Yep. Three new films just came out very quickly, Fahrenheit 451, a remake on Netflix, the Netflix original. Highly recommend it. Death of the Nation by Dinesh D'Souza, you should check that out. And also just check out how it was screened and where it was screened and for how long. That was very interesting. And Spike Lee's Black Klansman is a must-see, whatever your political views are, but it ends up with film footage from Charlottesville and makes very big statements about that. So I think that will be of great interest to people in the group.
But what is the title of that last one, please?
Black Klansman.
Oh, Black Klansman, yes, the movie. Okay.
Right. It's about a African-American police officer who, quote-unquote, infiltrates the KKK with a Jewish partner. So the black gentleman does... He infiltrates using his telephonic white voice, and the Jewish guy actually plays him in person and infiltrates the organization, and it's sort of like a COINTELPRO type of operation, but what information is revealed, how it's portrayed, will be very interesting for those who know about COINTELPRO and other operations, what's said, what's not said, how it's said.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. And any other announcements? Okay. Well, hearing no more, then I guess we'll see you all on the 26th of September. Be sure that you celebrate the anniversary of 9/11 in some meaningful way. And we'll see you all at the end of the month. Have a good night, everyone.
Okay.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Ken or Craig, are you still there?
Yes, and so is Marie Spite.
Okay.
Hi, yeah, I'm here.
I think we'll just she's probably not paying attention. I'll just drop her.
She just hung up.
Yeah, let me, I hung up.